Well, gay marriage is never far from anyone's lips these days, especially here in California, where the weddings are off again after the Ninth Circuit ruling last week. In our next segment, Lisa Detmer talks with Sarah Schulman, a leading lesbian cultural worker, scholar, and historian, about some of the issues that underlie the marriage debate. She has written 9 novels, 4 non-fiction books, and a play. She also co-wrote the screenplay for Cheryl Dunier's 2009 film, The Owls. She's a professor of English at the City University of New York. Her latest book is Ties That Bind, Familial Homophobia and Its Consequences, which was nominated for a Lambda Book Award. Coming up, Lisa Detmer talks with Sarah Schulman about this book and its implications for the current controversies over same-sex marriage.
So, Sarah, you talk in your book that while acceptance seems to be on the rise for gays, most gays have suffered demeanment because of being queer, and that usually starts at the home. Could you talk a little bit about how what you mean by that?
Sure. I think that the family is the place where most people first learn about homophobia. It's the first place where gay people experience homophobia, and it's the first place where straight people learn to use it as currency. And yet somehow this absolutely essential arena has been overlooked in the way we've decided to organize against homophobia. And, you know, what's so interesting in working on this, the book took me 13 years to write, and I had to coin the phrase familial homophobia because there wasn't even a name for this thing that most gay people experience and talk about all the time. It was just called it. You know, so, and I think one of the reasons that it just had never been articulated before, well, one is that it's so painful because it's very hard to accept the people you love the most or in that very profound way would be the perpetrators of this, which unfortunately they are, but also because it's so invisible and yet it has so many profound consequences. You know, part of working on the book meant really looking at this thing that is currently seen as normal, neutral, objective, and value-free, you know, just the way things are, which is familial homophobia, and starting to understand how it's constructed, how it's enforced, how it's maintained, what its consequences are, and how it can be undone. So to start with the first part, what I saw was that, you know, from the beginning, there's this concept of gay people as lesser than. Even for people who support gay rights or who practice, quote, tolerance, they're still positioning themselves, heterosexuals, as normative and neutral, and gay people as special interests who perhaps deserve certain kinds of acknowledgments. But what we don't see is the shift that I'm proposing, which is shifting the pathology from homosexuality to homophobia. To stop interrogating homosexuality and what causes it and all this sort of thing, and to accept it as a normal human variant and see that the problem is homophobia, that homophobia is a pathology, that it's antisocial, that it causes violence, that it destroys families, and that there's a social interest in disrupting it. So once we can make that shift, then we start to look at ways to undo the system. Now, when I was trying to imagine how to change this paradigm, I looked at history, which is always, you know, very helpful, and I saw that it's happened many times before. You know, the model is the shift from seeing being black as the problem to seeing racism as the problem. I mean, that's the clearest paradigm that we can rely on. But I also was very interested in how other, you know, private sphere questions like domestic violence or rape had been transformed in my lifetime. Like, for example, I'm 51. When I was a child, if you were raped in New York City, you couldn't get a conviction unless you had a witness. Today, rape is a crime in the world court. That's an enormous transformation. It doesn't mean that we don't live in a rape culture or that there's less rape, but it means that rape is seen completely differently and that people who experience it are treated differently and positioned socially in a different way than they were when I was a kid. The other example is domestic violence. You know, growing up in New York, if somebody was beating up his wife in an apartment, you know, people would never say anything. Now everyone knows that it's their social responsibility to call the police, to intervene in some way. So I think what's happened is we have already had experiences where violations that occur in domestic life or in the private sphere, we understand that they are so antisocial and cause so much damage to the individual and the culture that it's a necessity for the larger society to intervene and pathologize those behaviors. And I would like to apply those paradigms to familial homophobia as well.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because it is true that rape is illegal, but it's also still occurring all the time, and sexism is very accepted. So in some ways, I guess it seems like that is the situation with gays too. It's not that gay bashing or violence against gays may be seen as unacceptable in some cases, although in other cases it is acceptable, but that the more daily, everyday tolerance of homophobia seems to be very acceptable.
You know, you can never end violation. There's always going to be violation. That's just clear. You know, utopia will never be reached. But the thing is that there are many, many people who are just homophobic because they think they're supposed to be. They've just been trained to be that way. If the social norm was the opposite, most people would act in a different manner. Right now, there's a great benefit to being homophobic because it makes you feel better about yourself. You become superior because you're straight. Even if other things in your life are not going your way, there's an advantage to being homophobic because there's no consequence. However, if a consequence was created, it would no longer be advantageous. Now, of course, there are some people who are so pathological that no matter how much other people intervene, they will continue to be unaccountable in their behavior. That's true. But that's only a small group of people. The more consequence you create for homophobic behavior, the less likely people will be to engage in it. So, for example, for time immemorial, when a gay person was demeaned by their family, they might call up their friends and tell them what happened, but we would never, ever intervene. We would never pick up the phone and say to the family, "Hi, you don't know me, but I've been your son's best friend for 30 years. He is a very beloved person and a valuable person in this very large community, and many, many people care about what happens to him and how he's treated." See, we never did that. We privileged the family. We allowed them to be more important than the gay family member. And, you know, I think that time should come to an end. When we see gay people being violated by their families, by the arts and entertainment industry, by the state, or by each other, we have responsibility to intervene and create a consequence. And I really believe that on some level that can create a social transformation.
By us intervening, you mean the gay community or straight people?
Well, everyone. You know, ideally, if you're in a family where a gay person is being demeaned in some way, then you have a moral responsibility to intervene. You should refuse to participate in events or rituals in which they are demeaned. You have to intervene with other family members and tell them that this behavior is not acceptable. So straight people have the same responsibility. But gay people also have a responsibility to intervene. I mean, the example I give in my book is about these lesbian custody cases that we've been seeing. There's one in the press right now that's quite huge, where two women get together and they have a child in the context of the relationship. And then when they break up, usually the biological mother decides to punish her ex-lover by depriving her of access to the child. And in some cases, she gets away with it because the relationship was never recognized by the state. So the mother gets to re-victimize by extending the hand of the homophobic state. In other words, her partner, who she's seen all her life be demeaned by her family, by the arts and entertainment industry, by the state, is someone who's very easy for her to demean. And unless the immediate cadre of friends intervenes and makes it very, very clear that this is not acceptable, often there's no consequence at all.
Well, what about legally? If people are allowed to get married, would that not help?
Well, this is one of the interesting things about gay marriage that isn't raised quite often. I think that one of the many reasons that people want gay marriage is to be protected from each other. Because right now, frankly, gay people have the right to have the opportunity to violate their relationships in many ways without ever having to show cause or pay any kind of consequence. And if you had to show cause or go through some kind of process, it forces people to, you know, treat each other with more decency.
So do you think the gay marriage movement is helpful, or do you think that that we should be focusing on other things?
Well, it's not my game, gay marriage. But I'm saying let's be honest about why some of the reasons people want it. I mean, a lot of times people want to get married or have children because it's the only way they'll ever get the approval of their families. It's the only way they're ever going to feel normative or accepted in their communities. This is a negative reason. You know, we never go there. We don't discuss that, why we need this validation and what it's like not to have it. Because if we do get gay marriage, as the Supreme Court, which seems unlikely today considering the current balance, ends up granting gay marriage, what happens to gay people who don't get married or don't want to get married? They're still going to end up in the pathologized condition. So it's a really, really difficult problem. Of course, every American should have the same legal rights as every other American. I think there's no argument about that. But there are a lot of broader and deeper implications that need to be addressed.
Well, most people think that gay people have a lot of power and financially, and that they're highly, you know, that we have a lot of gay shows, Friends, L Word, Ellen. But you seem to disagree with that.
Well, that's laughable. I mean, in my field, I'm in the playwright. There's not one less authentic lesbian play in the American repertoire. And in terms of gay literature, I mean, in the early 90s, you would see multiple lesbian novels being published by mainstream presses. But in this current era, it's like one every two or three years. I mean, lesbian literature has virtually ceased to exist in mainstream U.S. publishing. You know, it's only British imports because they're less censored than we are. So there's really very, very, very little authentic lesbian representation in this country. And what we see on television is mostly sidekicks in the Tonto role, or else we see people who don't have any sexuality. Or most importantly, we see queer protagonists who never experience homophobia. I mean, there's this whole paradigm of the gay person who's afraid to come out, but there's not a single homophobic straight person on the horizon. It's a problem that they create themselves. You know, these types of false representations are pervasive, but you know, these are representations of containment and diminishment. These are not healthy, authentic, broadly truthful representations that integrate us into our own culture.
And they're often straight people playing gay people, like Native Americans used to be played by white people, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But you also challenge the use of going to therapy, which it seems to be every lesbian is in therapy, and that therapy hasn't really helped address this issue of homophobia.
Well, I'm not against the idea of therapy. I'm in favor of it. But I feel that the therapeutic industries that often act in loco parentis for gay people. I mean, for many gay people, the therapist is the only person in their life who's taking them seriously, you know, the only authority figure. That these industries have not created family treatment plans that address homophobic families, and certainly have not articulated how to treat homophobic trauma, the consequences of familial homophobia in gay people's lives. Instead, they often advise gay people to separate from their homophobic family, which is the opposite of what should be happening, because gay people deserve a family, and the homophobia should be identified and treated, not left to freely roam. So I think all of this has to be rethought.
And you also talk about how the strategy of being visible and coming out hasn't really succeeded, and that also the notion of homophobia as straight people being afraid of gays isn't true.
Well, I think, you know, that the movement made a mistake, which is an understandable one, years ago, when we thought that visibility was the thing that was going to, you know, help us and change our lives. And I think the reason we made that mistake was because we really believed that the reason people were cruel to us is because they didn't know us, and that if they would know us, they would love us. Today, we have enormous visibility. We have, you know, gazillions of Americans watching Ellen on TV, and yet we've lost 31 out of 31 ballot measures. So what's happening now is that the visibility has not changed straight people's willingness to examine themselves, to see that they are not neutral, they are not objective, they are not value-free, we are not special interest. These are the things that visibility does not change.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to the
audience? No, I just want to say that I've had an amazing experience with this book. People have responded with this incredible emotional urgency and have, you know, really connected with me in a very intimate way about the ideas in the book. And it's been very reassuring that we still have a very, very rich and strong community that actually respond to truthful investigations about our own condition.
Sarah Schulman is the author of Ties That Bind, Familial Homophobia and Its Consequences. Her novels include The Sophie Horowitz Story and People in Trouble, which she claims was the uncredited inspiration for the hit musical Rent. In the late 80s and early 90s, she was active in ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, and has co-founded the AIDS Activist Oral History Project. She recently became one of the most prominent LGBT authors and artists to join the movement for boycott, sanctions, and divestment against Israel. She spoke with Women's Magazine's Lisa Detmer.